This morning we talked with Charles Bottomley of Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont for our book list, and they have traveled around the literary globe to collect these tomes. After spending lots of time reading dozens of books and studying up, Charles joins us this morning with a terrific list of books to share. Charles, good morning. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
A pleasure to have you with us. Charles joined us at the, we sent out an 11th hour call for help from a bookseller, and Charles rose to the occasion and had a list ready to go, and we thank you very much for filling in at the last minute. Where would you like to begin?
Well, at 50 Shades of Grey, Joe. Have you heard about it?
Yeah, a thing or two.
In that case, we don't have to talk about it.
Okay, good.
Instead, allow me to steer you towards Rachel Joyce's debut novel, The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry. I'm the kind of person that when I first started working at the Northshire Bookstore, I had not read any book that had been published after 1899, and I realized I better become a bit more up-to-date with contemporary literature. So what I like to do is whenever there is a literary prize that is announced, I like to try to read one of the prize winners or the kind of shortlist that they have. And The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry has appeared on the Booker long list. That's the big literary prize in England. And England being England, whenever they have a literary prize, somehow the whole country gets involved, and it's always quite entertaining to read the debate about some of the selections. And this year's list includes titles like Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel, which has been very popular here. It also includes some books which have yet to be published in the United States, Nicola Barker's The Yips being one of them. But Rachel Joyce's The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry has made the list. It's her debut novel, and it's the kind of book that I would expect to hate, because it is about a middle-aged man who receives a letter in the post from an old work colleague and learns that she is dying of cancer. And he decides that what he's going to do is he's going to walk from where he lives, which is Kingsbridge on the south coast of England, to Berwick-upon-Tweed, which is 600 miles to the north. And he's going to kind of deliver his final message to this dying woman in person. He believes that as long as he keeps walking, that the woman is going to stay alive. Now, this is the recipe, as far as I'm concerned, for something that contains a lot of sort of middle-aged angst and stiff upper lips and kind of this sort of scenario where you expect Judy Dench to turn up any minute.
Right.
But I've been absolutely knocked out by this book. It is, first of all, the appearance of an absolutely wonderful storyteller, a author who knows how to use words and sentences so that everything counts, and so that the story is not just what you're reading, but also kind of what is going on beneath. Harold Fry, who is the titular hero of the story, as he walks through the landscape of Britain, he reflects on his past life, and he is estranged from his son. His wife has been disapproving of Harold for about the last two decades, and the woman who he's going to see, he hasn't seen for 20 years either. But the people that he meets are very quickly sketched characters who gradually turn this man who really hasn't left the house in like the last 3 years into a fully fledged human being. And one of the other things I like about it is that a lot of the books I've read that have come out of England at the moment are state of the nation novels. They've kind of taken their cue from Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, and they're trying to write these very big books that say everything there is to say about Britain. And what Joyce has done is she has actually taken a very small-scale story, and she has kind of shown us the decency that lies at the heart of these people. You know, books like John Lanchester's Capital is a very excellent novel, but essentially it gives us a London that is largely populated by scumbags. And, you know, Harold Fry, as you read it, you like him more and more and more. And I tend to like novels that make you feel bad, but this novel has made me feel good, and it's a novel feeling, and I kind of like it.
The Unlikely Pilgrimage of Harold Fry by Rachel Joyce. Next.
Next. Well, I'm still, you can tell I'm a bit of an Anglophile, and I've grown up loving the music of David Bowie, who sadly has been silent for the last couple of years since suffering an aneurysm on stage. But I enjoy reading books of music criticism and books about rock stars, and one of the best books that I've read in absolutely years is completely free of the sort of waffle that is usually associated with rock criticism. Frank Zappa once said that writing about rock music was a bit like dancing about architecture. But this is just a book which really kind of takes the lightning in the bottle that comes from a great single or album and presents it on the page. It's called The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 1970s. And it's by the critic Peter Doggett, whose last book was actually You Never Give Me Your Money, which was about the Beatles after they broke up, what they ended up doing, and how they still kind of functioned as a corporate entity, not a band. What he has done is he has gone through the David Bowie catalog, song by song, and he shows how each song was a product of the culture of the 1970s. Not so much the polyester, maybe, and the flared trousers, but more the kind of feelings of impending apocalypse, the kind of disappointment with government and the sort of institutions that represented our ideals, the embrace of androgyny and the kind of fruitless pursuit of hedonistic pleasure, and also the retreat into forms of mysticism like the tarot. It begins actually in 1969 with David Bowie's kind of breakthrough hit Space Oddity and carries on to 1980, where he released what many people consider to be his last truly great album, Scary Monsters. It's really interesting because when people talk about David Bowie, they tend to talk about how he was a chameleon. They call him a pop chameleon. He started out as a glam rocker, then became a sort of soul man. In the 1980s, he essentially transformed himself into a kind of lukewarm variant on Michael Jackson or Tina Turner. He became a sort of huge star, even as he was making some of the least compelling music of his career. And Doggett kind of explains that one of the reasons for this is that Bowie was actually very much like Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan wanted to become a star, and then once he became a star, realized that he hated it. And he decided he was going to try to meet his audience head-on and essentially confound their expectations every turn. So Bowie goes from kind of wild-haired folky to serious singer-songwriter. He gets into blue-eyed soul. He moves to Berlin and starts making electronic experimental music. He makes an album called Lodger, in which he basically discovers kind of ethno-funk and does Graceland before Paul Simon's Graceland. And then, I mean, he brings everything full circle in 1980 when he releases Ashes to Ashes, which is actually a song about the character in Space Oddity, who was an astronaut who blasted off into space and decided just to stay there. He didn't want to come back to Earth. Bowie treated the part of being the rock star as a kind of canvas. He said in an interview, maybe I'm not into rock and roll, maybe I just use rock and roll. And the great thing about this book and about what Doggett has done is he's connected the dots between the songs, between the albums as collections of songs, the cover art, the promotional films, the TV appearances, film appearances, stage costumes, everything that Bowie was involved with during that decade. And he said, let's instead of just calling this guy a pop chameleon, let's actually take him serious as an artist, and let's consider him to be as deep a thinker as about what he did as, you know, I mean, this might be a bit highfalutin, but, you know, sort of William Shakespeare or, you know, Henry James or Andy Warhol or, you know, sort of any of those people. And I really think this is a book that kind of takes a guy who's often derided as a kind of glam Muppet and, you know, Ziggy Stardust and all that, and really says he is as serious an artist and as brilliant a musician as Bob Dylan.
The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie in the 1970s by Peter Doggett. We've got about 5 minutes left. Where would you like to go next?
Well, then, I think we're probably only going to have the Radon Talk, and we're only going to have time for one more book, but I'm very pleased to get to this one because this is without a doubt my favorite book of 2012. And, I mean, being a bookseller, you're always picking up books. You're always looking for the thing that is really going to turn you on. And for every book that you end up talking about and think is great, you've also struggled with about 10 other books that just really haven't, you know, pushed your buttons. And I did not hardly expect it to get from this book, which is called Fire in the Belly, The Life and Times of David Wojnarowicz. I can't pronounce his name, but it's Wojnarowicz. He was an artist who lived from 1954 to 1992. He worked in a variety of disciplines. He was a painter, a photographer, a writer, a filmmaker, a performance artist, a musician, and a graffiti artist. He died when he was 37 years old in 1992 from age-related complications. And if anybody knows his work, they probably know it because they're U2 fans. His 1989 photograph, Buffalo Falling, was used in a U2 video, and it was also the art for their single One. And if you tend to read the news and you get a bit sniffy about arts funding, you might also know him because his film, Fire in the Belly, in 2010, was actually removed from a Smithsonian exhibition after the Catholic League and John Boehner complained about the imagery within it. They were very upset about 11 seconds in this 20-minute film that featured ants crawling over a crucifix. So even, you know, in his afterlife, Voinovich is as controversial as he was when he was alive. He essentially worked, his work kind of flowered in the 1980s. He discovered himself as an artist, and his work really achieved a kind of clarity as AIDS started taking all his friends that lived in the Lower East Side. He became a very important AIDS activist. The book really reminds me of, you know, Patti Smith's Just Kids, which has been a huge bestseller here. But Smith's was kind of a Cinderella story, and Voinovich is not. After his parents separated, his alcoholic father kidnapped the kids. His mother locked them in the attic when she would go out for a day. His father famously took the pet rabbit of the family and actually served it to them for dinner, saying it was lamb. So it's no surprise that when he moved in with his mother into New York, Voinovich wanted to get out of there as quickly as possible, and he actually worked for a time as a hustler on Times Square, back when it really was Times Square and not the kind of shopping mall that we are familiar with today. And as an artist, he was inspired both by kind of Jack Kerouac, you know, the author of On the Road, the kind of king of the beats, and Arthur Rimbaud, the teenage French poet who essentially aimed at a kind of derangement of all the senses. He really had an affinity for the downtrodden and the forgotten, bums, hustlers, prostitutes, people beaten down by life. He was also attracted to kind of thugs and the desperation of the way that they used power. And, you know, which made him a kind of perfect representative for a kind of gay subculture that really was identifying itself through art and through music, through all the mediums that he operated in the 1980s. You know, sort of the book is so fantastic because it literally gives us this guy minute by minute. It draws on his journals. It draws on interviews with him. The author, Cynthia Carr, was a Village Voice journalist who knew Voinovich well. She talks to everybody, his contemporaries who are still alive, and they are able to give you an idea of who he is. And what you are looking at is just the forming of a sensibility and the blossoming of an imagination, and a sentimental education of sorts of a person who really should be out of place and probably should have ended up dead in a dumpster somewhere, and instead started making art and made art anywhere. He used graffiti. He ended up sort of turning a disused pier that was a magnet for gay cruising into his own studio and started a small arts community there. And although you would never know it from walking around the Lower East Side now, he and his fellow artists essentially took a apocalyptic wasteland and, you know, turned it into a thriving arts community whose, you know, subtlety and the impact of their work, I think we really need to continue to pay attention to. What they were dealing with is still the same kind of things that we were dealing with now.
Name of the book is Fire in the Belly by Cynthia Carr. Fire in the Belly by Cynthia Carr. For more information on the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester, Vermont, you can go to their website, northshire.com. Bookseller Charles Bottomley, I thank you very much for being with us and sharing your picks with us. A great pleasure.
Please also follow us on Twitter at Northshire Books and also become a friend of us on Facebook. And thank you very much, Joe, for the opportunity.
Northshire.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.